while all cars in Australia quietly go to the great big farm in the sky, in other markets, they get a new lease on life. But where, why, and how? Yes, it's time to strap in for another edition of the Cars Guide podcast, the show that takes you beyond the test drive. This is episode 199, Zombie Car Apocalypse. I'm Cars Guide Deputy Editor James, and joining me to discuss this rise of the driving dead is Cars Guide Senior Editor Richard.
Oh, g'day.
And key contributor Byron.
Hello, everybody.
We'll lift up the B&D roller door and peer into the corners of the Cars Guide garage, looking back on our hero cars and memorable drives. Then we'll dive into your feedback. YouTubers, if you want to plot your own adventure, you can jump ahead courtesy of the time codes in the notes below, and you can click on the chapter markers in the timeline. And yes, the Melbourne lad who commented on last week's show, we hear you. No time codes, no stamps. Mr. Pritchard has paid his penance, and we have reinstated those from last week's show, but they'll be in this week, that's for sure. So let's hit the start button. And it's brilliant that you're with us, Byron, because one of your stories during the week has created a lot of interest. And it's about cars that have been retired from this market, but continue on happily in other parts of the world. And the premise is that we have Australian design regulations that are pretty strict about safety things, all kinds of mandatory stuff that a car has to have that may not be the case elsewhere. So they don't cut the mustard here, but they continue on happily elsewhere. And we've gone through a whole bunch of different models. Before we start, though, it puts me in mind of a story that I think you wrote for Wheels Mag about cars that had a second life and changed well after they disappeared from the Aussie market. And the one that blew my mind was the LJ Tirana. Do you recall that story? And it was, I think it was sold up in Korea as a Chevrolet, and they had a wagon version as well, which was just extraordinary.
Well, yes, I remember that. And actually, that was probably the genesis of this story, combined with the fact that used cars are so expensive and new cars are unobtainable at the moment for so many reasons. I started thinking, how about kind of combining the two, a new used car that you can buy overseas? And then, you know, that led down a rabbit hole. But yes, that's right. So the car we're talking about, or you're talking about, is the, I think it was called the Chevrolet 1700.
1700, yeah, it was.
And it was a wagon version of the LJ Tirana, but it was launched after the LH Tirana was launched in Australia. And I, from... please, if you are a reader or a watcher or a listener and you know better, please let us know. But I believe it was Holden selling the tooling of the LJ Tirana to what became Daewoo.
That's right.
And they improved it by having this quite handsome wagon version, which looks like it was designed to have from the beginning. Mm. And this Chevy 1700 was in production in one form or another until the early 90s.
I know. It's amazing,
crazy,
right?
Crazy.
Yeah.
So, and that, of course, got me thinking that there are other cars that have just been around for years and years, long after they shuffled off the Australian mortal coil.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Well, the first one we want to start with is...
Can I just say... I was a bit disappointed in Byron's story.
Because
when I read the headline, I thought it was cars you should pick for the zombie apocalypse.
The apocalypse.
And then I saw things like Pulsar and so I'm like, what? You'd never pick a Pulsar for the zombie apocalypse.
Well, maybe you want to fly Cruiser. Under the radar. You don't want to be a big target, do you? You don't want to set
even the zombies
up.
Aren't going to want to touch
that's right.
that.
Yeah. That's it.
Anyway,
that's it.
Sorry, I had to put that in there.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know. I'm not perfect, but maybe next time we'll
it's a good story in the end, I found.
Thank you.
Mark that admission down. Mark that admission down.
I'm not perfect.
Byron Matthew Darkus, 10th of September, 2021. Okay. Now, but the one we start with wouldn't be bad in a zombie apocalypse because it's a tough kind of high riding. It's a four-wheel drive. It's got the looks to put people off. And Richard, you were mentioning before the show, how many of your friends and acquaintances have been wondering why it's not on sale anymore?
Yeah.
It's the FJ Cruiser from Toyota.
I thought
Toyota.
You were going to say Daihatsu Terios, but yes, you're right.
the Micra.
FJ Cruiser, and it actually, over time, it came here late, Byron, as you mentioned in your story. It had been on sale elsewhere for yonks, but it came here, And it got a really devoted following. The customization started to take off. But in 2017, it just wasn't there anymore in terms of tech and all those things. It disappeared, and yet it's on sale elsewhere.
Well, it boggles the mind. Like, can you imagine if that car was on sale right now? It would be flying out the showrooms.
It would.
Absolutely. It would be having its best year, probably, you know, also supercharged by the fact that the Ford Bronco and there's been a new Jeep Wrangler out in the last couple of years. I think it's revived that kind of retro 4x4 kind of heritage, historic kind of movement. And I reckon Toyota is really, really missing a trick not having that car.
I think you alluded to it in your story, Byron. It's almost become retro on retro in that it launched as a retro, like a love letter to the Land Cruiser, but it hung around for so long that it became like a long-lived model in its own right.
Yeah.
Did you know, look, I was talking to previous employees of Toyota who have left the company now, and that there's a widespread sorrow when they had to pull that vehicle out of their lineup, because it was one of, internally at Toyota Australia, it was one of their favorite cars, and they could see how, you know, potential it had, what was coming in the market. We had retro style minis. As you were saying, it would go really, really well today. They knew that it was based on a formidable, you know, Prado chassis, so it was off-road capable and it looked like Lego. They knew it was a winner, but they had to pull it.
Yeah, and you know what? I tend, and you guys are probably the same. We tend to think of ourselves as kind of knowledgeable about reviewing cars and assessing cars and recommending cars. I remember not long ago, while the car was still available, a friend of mine said, "I'm thinking of buying an FJ Cruiser." This is like in early 2017, and she's a photographer at Wheels Magazine, actually, Alan Dewar. And I said to Alan, "Oh, don't buy one of those. Like, it's thirsty and it's got those impractical doors and it'll drive you crazy.
Suicide doors.
And, you know," and she went, "Oh, as if you know what you know what you're talking about." She went and bought one. And now that thing is worth about 20 grand more than what she paid for it, because she bought a great color. She looked after it, and it just does not let her down. So it goes to show how little I know. And
well, I think it was, as you say in your story, it's things like safety, the overall refinement, economy that engine was falling off the pace, and just the general tech. I mean, I suppose to go for another generation of that car, you left with a decision. It was a retro tribute to a former car. Do we then continue it through various iterations like the Mini? Or just salute it and say, job well done, you know, goodbye. But it continues elsewhere.
I feel terrible in the same way that Byron does, because I've talked people out of an FJ as well. I've got a mate who lives in WA and he's part of, you know, their huge four-wheel driving scene. And he's like, "What about an FJ Cruiser? They look great." And I've got a few friends who've got them. And I talked him out of it based on practicality. I said, look, it's a big off-road vehicle, but at the same time, those little, you know, backward opening doors, the suicide doors at the back, are just going to be a problem for you. But now I'm thinking, all right, he should have just gone for it.
Yeah.
Well, it could be a private import from South America or Africa or the Middle East, where it's still being sold.
We need to be forgiven, I think, there, Mr. Henry.
Yes.
Yeah. And but James, you were saying earlier that there may be a replacement.
Well, that's right. The thing that I've thought of occasionally, in that the FJ Cruiser was this entree into a new world of Toyota, where they were more adventurous and certainly more creative in terms of the stuff they're offering. There was to be a sort of replacement for FJ Cruiser, which was the TJ Cruiser, an even chunkier, more chiseled looking thing, I think a little smaller in terms of its overall footprint. But I thought, bring that on. Yeah. And so far, there's been deafening silence.
It might come. It might still be in production.
An electric version, maybe?
Maybe.
To rival Hummer, Rivian, that type of thing that's coming.
Who knows? But I just love the look of that concept. A little bit divisive, but I was on the love it side.
So if you're watching this in South Africa, You're probably thinking, what are these guys talking about? I can go pick one up in my local Durban dealer. But yeah,
no, exactly. No, they'd be saying, what are these guys talking about?
It's right-hand drive, the whole bit. Yeah, just get one on a boat, get it over here.
Maybe just bring it back. Anyway.
Now, look, let's move on to the next one. Some of these we'll dwell on, some not so much. But the next one's another Toyota, and it's the Corolla sedan that left our market in 2019. And we had that divide between hatch and sedan at that point. They were quite different cars, weren't they, Byron? And this one, again, it's the previous generation sedan, but it's being manufactured in Pakistan and South Africa and in China.
So I actually think this is one of the prettiest three-box small cars in a long time. And it's sold as strongly on looks as it did on Toyota reliability and practicality. And also, it's got more rear leg room and seat room than a Camry of only one or two generations ago.
Righto. Yeah.
I think that this sort of car should return to Australia as an old school style Toyota that is accessible and dependable and, you know, it just adheres to the traditional Toyota virtues. I think Toyota is marching upmarket a little bit. We're in the time when we're in an era now where the cheapest Yaris cost $26,000.
That's right.
Those cars used to be
30 grand.
Yeah. Those cars were 21 or 22.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, they're right. Still around. What do you reckon, Richard? Do you agree?
I reckon this reminds me of, because I'm a member of the Skoda Rapid Spaceback Club worldwide. And did you know?
Oh, sorry, I thought it was the Space Cadet Club you were.
I've seen the membership tag
that you wear on your keyring there.
Yeah, you do. You actually got to wear it on your belt. Yeah. You do. Yes. Yeah. That Corolla story reminds me of the fact that even though in every other market of the world the Rapid was replaced by the Scala, in Russia the Rapid, the Skoda Rapid, is so popular it's still being made, and they've sort of updated it. And look, I think you're right.
Rapidsky, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's called the Rapidsky.
The Rapidsky. Yes. It is. Yeah, look, I think you're right. I think Toyota is marching, you know, up towards a high end. But there are that cheap and cheerful segment is being filled by, I would say, you know, other brands like Chinese brands. Kia used to sort of fill that segment as well, and that's sort of moving up too. And so Hyundai doesn't really have anything too affordable these days.
Toyota's history, I'd say you could learn from it in that Toyota's good at creeping a car up, as a lot of makers are. They tend to see, right, if you're a RAV4 buyer, we're going to grow the car with you as you move through different life stages. You'll buy another RAV4 because it's slightly bigger and it'll accommodate your family. And then something comes in underneath, CHR arrives, bang. Mm. And then it starts to shift up and they just backfill the space underneath. So I don't know. You never know what's going to come out under these other cars that are growing in prestige and price and size.
That's true. But Byron, what do you want? Do you want just a Toyota with a steering wheel and just wheels and, you know, roll down windows?
I can deal, and no multimedia screen, because you can nowadays just use your phone.
Not while you're driving.
No, like you can the and as demonstrated in a recent motor show car, and it'll come to me where it's just got one of the, I think it was the Dacia Sandero, the base model, just has a cradle for where you put your phone on the dash.
Phone,
it plugs in. It acts as GPS and possibly even a reverse camera or all that sort of stuff if you wire it up properly. Yeah, I can. I don't need people.
No frills car. Yeah, yeah, very interesting.
And what I think that Toyota should do that, and combined with their know-how and the fact that they've got legacy technology, i.e. stuff that's been proven around for years and years and years, it's been around for ages, it doesn't break down, I think that they could be on a winner.
No,
you don't have to call a Corolla.
You're absolutely right, because at the moment there's a whole lot of BS from car makers talking about how they are mobility companies and they're changing their name from car manufacturers and car makers to providing mobility solutions. If they really wanted to provide mobility solutions, they would make a car for $10,000 or for $5,000 that didn't have a screen, didn't necessarily have, you know, climate adaptive control and adaptive cruise control.
Because all that
don't need that.
All that
you don't need that.
Yeah, you don't. Yes.
But to have AEB, you need that. You know, you need that ability, and you know, it's the safety standards, isn't it? You're gonna have to sell a car. Otherwise, we'd all be driving Tata Nanos.
Do you need AEB and though?
It just wouldn't.
Is AEB a requirement for a car to be sold? Or is it just a requirement to get that ridiculous 5-star ANCAP rating that ANCAP so-called hand out willy-nilly?
Good question. I'm not sure. Because I think stability and traction became mandatory some time ago.
Around 20.
You'd have those. Yeah. You'd have those. Yeah. You'd have stability and traction. Yeah. But and I mean, have, all those
you'd
plush
have power
interior.
Brakes. Yes. You'd have hydraulic brakes, I think. Yes. You'd also have.
A rack and pinion, power rack and pinion.
Yeah, power rack and pinion. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I reckon.
Look, let's keep going. Let's accelerate through the next one. It was a one-year wonder, the Nissan Almera. And Byron, you summed it up beautifully. High prices, low equipment levels, regarded as, quote, one of the worst new cars of the past decade.
Oh, and also one of the ugliest. It looks like the zombie apocalypse came and had its way.
Look, let's just say that people in parts of Asia and Africa and South America can still buy one and move on to the next vehicle.
Just before you do, I just want to point out that that car came to Australia because I went to the launch in 2013. I went to the launch of that car. It came with no folding rear seat, yet it has a posterior the size of a
big thing.
And I'm a cyclist. It was useless. That car was used. It was ugly. It was slow. It was unrefined. It was expensive, and good riddance.
Fine. Well, it didn't think much of you either, Byron. But that's just
no one does.
The next one I think would just make Crafty's heart sing, because we're talking about the D22 Navara, and it's nearing its silver anniversary. But it was pulled from Australia in 2015.
15, but it's another, can you believe that?
It's another one that soldiered on, and we were talking just a few moments ago about amortizing the cost of tooling and development and all of that stuff. That's one that would have paid for itself long ago, but it's on sale elsewhere.
Mm. Carlos Ghosn would definitely have, been impressed with the money or the return on investment on that thing. That car, yes, it was. It sold pretty well in Australia up until the early 2010s because it was affordable. It looked good. Nissan did a really good job of like dressing that car up too, with the alloys and the STL version or STX or STR, whatever it was called. And you still see them. And they had the basics, ABS, dual airbags, as well.
Maybe it's the no-frills car.
Yes.
Maybe it's very close to what would be the no-frills vehicle.
Yeah.
There's plenty of people who live in rural settings who don't want to have to spend $53,000 on a brand new Navara and just want something they can drive on their property and then to the shops.
Richard, was that a bit of real estate copy there? People that live in a rural setting, as opposed to the bush.
Look, I think Richard, you bring
set
something
on 5,000 square meters.
It's a fixer upper.
I think Richard brings up an interesting point though, and this is something that happens in New Zealand with the Suzuki Sierra that's still available there.
And
that is, you can have a farm vehicle, a new farm vehicle that you can buy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you are rural based or, you just, need a workhorse, the Navara D22, which ran from 97 to 2015, still fits the bill. And I'm sure that's why it's sold in many other countries in the world. But, for those who are, who are living more urban or, freeway or motorway kind of settings, maybe this is where cars like the Great Wall that are cheaper, that have AEB and adaptive cruise control come into their own, I think. Mm. They may not quite have the longevity and the proven reliability of a car that's been around for 25 years, but, I think that serves a particular market.
Yeah,
I love New Zealand. I love New Zealand.
Oh, I think so. I think, so do I. If it comes to just random signs of affection for our near neighbours, I love New Zealand too.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I want to give them that cuddle.
On the Nissan theme, the Micra, the 2010 to 2016 Micra, Byron, you very diplomatically described it as not Nissan's finest moment, the third generation Micra. It shrank a bit. And it lacked sophistication. It was feeling pretty cheap and a little bit crude. And in Europe, sales fell so spectacularly that a reskin version of the Renault Clio took over 5 years ago. So, but it soldiers on elsewhere also.
Well, that car has a bit of the Navara D22 in it, in that it was clearly built down to a price for, you know,
it's low price.
Yeah, yeah. And it seemed kind of rough and ready and hardy and all those those words that you use to actually mean like cheap plastics and, you know, indestructible.
Right. Yeah.
And is it a coincidence that that Micra was is related to the Almira, which was basically a sedan version of that Micra?
I think not a coincidence.
No. Anyway, I think that car was so cheap to build. It just was too cheap to build, and it just didn't fool more sophisticated markets where we're used to cars like the Polo and the Fiesta and the Mazda 2, you know, and the Renault Clio, for that matter, that want sophisticated equipment.
Well,
and
just to keep us moving along, that's a good segue into the next one, which is the Polo, which in 2010 was a massive new generation, such a big change for that car, and it lasted until 2016. And it is still going in as the Polo Vivo. And I think one market I identified is South Africa.
So when you say still going, do you mean there's one example that's still on the road?
Yeah, just
or do
one
you mean
that's still just pottering around.
It was serviced very regularly, I think.
On the Velt. it was when it arrived, I remember first driving that 2010 Polo and going, what a great little car. It had the... I think it was a 1.4 Atmo, and then there was a another engine option, doesn't come to mind.
A 1.2 turbo.
1.2 turbo, that's right. Yeah. Both of them were so nice. The car was such a complete package for its time.
Yeah.
And I think you made the point in the story, Byron, that keep it in market now and it would still stack up pretty well. And I agree. In terms of refinement, it was just terrific.
Yeah, indeed. That one, that was the first car of the year that I was involved with.
Okay.
Where it won.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's still... Still, I'd have a six-speed manual version with that 1.2 liter engine, turbo engine, any day. It's really good.
On the topic of Volkswagen, didn't Brazil only just finish producing the Beetle and Combi?
If it was
2003, but still, just the day. Like, you know, 40 years after it was, you know, the production elsewhere stopped, they continued building it. Yeah. And I think that's good.
Yes. Hmm. Was there not a version of the Combi in Brazil where it was
By the way, that was Mexico, not Brazil.
Sorry, Mexico.
In Mexico, where it was water-cooled and there was an ungainly radiator plugged onto the front of it or something like that?
That was definitely the case for the T2 Transporter.
Yeah, anyway, sorry. Yes. We're off topic. Yeah. Now, moving on.
Talk about the Ford EcoSport.
Yes, let's talk about the Ford EcoSport.
Because that was a piece of...
This is one to me that sounds like it was intended for other markets, one in particular, but it leaked out to other parts of the world with mixed success, particularly here. It had a six-year run, but, you know, as you say, Byron, really good engine, but just didn't have the kind of all-round quality and sophistication that you'd expect for the price and that Ford should bring to the
Hang
table.
Hang on. Wait, what? What? The EcoSport had a really good engine?
One of the versions did. It had the
three-cylinder turbo.
Turbo, yeah.
Have you driven it? Have you driven that car
lately?
From Sydney?
Have you driven
to Sydney to Maitland up the Newcastle Freeway?
Yep.
With
several
that
times.
Three-cylinder?
No, I haven't. No.
Honestly, it could not decide what gear ever it wanted to be in. I spent my holiday not able to get our luggage out of the boot because it's got a wide barn door hinged.
Was that a manual car, Richard? And it couldn't decide what gear it wanted to be.
It was the auto.
We're talking about a manual. But, Richard, we're talking about, I specifically pointed out the manual.
Oh, all right. Well,
okay.
Yes. Well, that's fine.
There we go.
Still, Charles, a piece of crap.
No, look, it's based on the Fiesta platform. It had.
Which Fiesta? From the
WS Fiesta.
Do you mean Festiva?
No. Fiesta.
No.
Look, the car was developed for the Brazilian market, but
there you go.
It was done in Ford of India did a lot of the packaging work. I think I seem to recall, because I did go to the launch of that car, which was in India,
in
the early 2010s. And there's a lot of things that I like about that car. And when they took that spare wheel off the tailgate, which they did very late in the life of the car,
yes,
it really improved that car's urban usability, because
it had a hidden hat latch to open the boot, which took me about 3 days to work out.
Yeah, it was
tail light,
James. That was because it was childproof. Look, I just think that car isn't as bad as people say. I found that the interior quality was a bit.
I think there was actually a big handle labeled Batman Batcave style. Saying
it was. It was honestly. It was one of the cars that I almost just left on the side of the road and walked.
Look, here's my PSA. Here's my PSA, folks. Because SUVs are so expensive, new or used, if you find a manual EcoBoost, EcoSport, just try saying that fast, particularly
EcoSport,
with a service history, I think you'll find it enjoyable, compact, because it has to be under 4 meters. It had to be under 4 meters long in the body, which is why the spare wheel was slung from the rear.
Well, I'm 2 meters in the body, and. Me personally, I'm 2 meters in the body, so I don't fit into a car that's.
But the car had German engineering. Essentially,
such a crap line that car manufacturers roll out.
No,
German manufacturing engineering.
It could fit the 99th percentile, 95th percentile male could fit in it because had a lot of leg room. But anyway. I think we spent too much time on the EcoSport. What do you reckon?
Let's move on to another quality vehicle, which of course is the Pulsar. 2012 to 2017 on sale here. Now, this was also post a period of confusion with Pulsar, Tita, Pulsar. It felt like the higher-ups in Nissan in Japan just said, this car is going to be called Tita now. No one in Australia was happy about it.
Yeah, they fought it.
Lot of equity in the Pulsar name in this market. Tita, I discovered, means sun in the Okinawan dialect of Japanese. I never knew that. I just looked that up this morning. It means sun. Mm. But it wasn't exactly a sunny time for the Pulsar. It was...
I went to that launch in 2012.
Did you?
And you could, even with a brand new car sitting on a velvet rotating dial, you could see how the side skirts had been roughly bolted to the side of the car.
Well, like a hole in a self-tapper or something.
It was really bad.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here again.
God,
I think that it's one of those cars that Nissan does well, inexpensive. Spacious, like bigger than usual for its class. That 1.8 litre engine was fine. It came with an optional 1.6 turbo, which is actually quite lovely with a manual transmission. I didn't mind the looks of it in terms of when in hatch form. No one liked it. It was just, in the end, it was just a bit fugly. The interior seemed old, but it had a pretty good chassis. Like, it had some Renault DNA in that.
Look, knowing now what Nissan were going through with their absent father, Carlos Ghosn, who was channeling all the funds elsewhere, they were doing the best with what, allegedly, of course. We don't know for sure. I mean, even though he smuggled himself out in a violin case.
Wouldn't we all if we could?
To be that flexible again.
Double bass.
Look, they were doing the best with what they had, I think. And I think internally they knew that it wasn't, ideal.
Yeah. So anyway, that car, because of its sheer cheapness, is still around in markets where that's an important thing.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a bad thing. And I think that, I'd like to see a Nissan passenger car, an affordable Nissan passenger car again in Australia.
Yep. Here's one where in the 90s, I already saw it as, geez, that's an old car. It's hung around. It's more than a decade old. And it went on for close to another decade, being the classic Lada Niva, which was on sale here for some time.
Yes.
It's now sold as a hip kind of retro machine, your word, Byron, in the UK. It's now under Renault control, and they've confirmed that it's going to continue until 2023. So that'll be a 40-year run if that replacement actually transpires.
Yeah, 40, almost 45 years, I think. Yeah. Look, that car had a bit of German Volkswagen of the time engineering. They helped.
Was that the wheel covers or something more substantial?
Look, I think the early cars used a Volkswagen engine block too, I think. It had some Golf elements. I'm not sure, but I can't recall. But anyway, people love Nevas. People love Nevas the same way that people love FJ Cruisers, in a very scaled down, in a very,
it's more of a niche, isn't it? Yes.
Iron curtain sort of way.
Yeah.
Look, I think it's a nice piece of industrial design. It's a great city-sized vehicle. And they are, I think they're appallingly made, or they were.
Yes.
But, one of the few
cars that I've had deconstruct itself around me is a Lada. It wasn't a Neva, but it just started to, the whole focus on end-of-life recycling for cars, this one was way ahead of itself. It was just wanted to put itself in different bins for the components.
I had a mate who had a Lada Neva in the 90s. And, I agree with you, Byron. It was a really fun car. And It was fun to drive, but I was constantly picking him up off the side of the road. And that was...
That was after you'd had a blue.
That was it. There's nothing to do with the car.
Just get up.
A few drinks and fell over.
Is it because you were selecting the gears? Because you thought it was automatic?
It was. No, it was. Come on. That EcoSport, man. No. It was always breaking down. And I was either driving him to the mechanic to, pick it back up or, pick him up at, where are you? I'm at Norman's McDonald's, right? It's broken down in the car park. It was to drive, and it reminded me of a TCV that I had years and years ago. They are... You talk about cut price and a raw driving experience. And it's a little bit, driving it was a little bit Suzuki Jimny about it as well. Yeah. There's that same sort of quality where it's like, whoa, it's just me and the car. There's nothing between us.
Mixed with a certain sense of satisfaction when you actually reach your destination.
Oh, absolutely.
As opposed to, yes.
Look, all right,
we made it.
The next one, let's keep going. Suzuki Alto. So Suzuki Alto was 2009 to 2014. In this market, tiny little car. It proved, as you say, Byron, reasonably successful. Another one that was built in India, Maruti of India built the car, but wasn't so much fun to drive. Is it still sold in India then, I presume, Byron? Would that be one of the markets where it's still on sale?
Yeah, very much so. And it's very bottom of the range. Alto has been India's best-selling nameplate, I think, on and off years and years and years. Okay. I mean, that car is, the Alto is the Corolla of that part
the
of the
subcontinent.
World. Yeah. But I actually I'm going to give a shout out to the Celerio that replaced in Australia. I thought that car was listening. A cracker.
That's right.
Suzuki Celerio.
Regular viewer.
This reminds me, either myself or Byron or JC, we need to write a story off the back of Byron's story, where it's cars that should have left Australia that are still here, Suzuki S-Cross. What the heck is the Suzuki S-Cross still doing in Australia? And why does it still have the little? It's still got the little. What did it used to be called when it was in Australia?
SX4.
Yes, and it's still got that on the back of the tailgate. It's not even four-wheel drive.
Yeah, well, it's
that shouldn't be here.
It's going to continue, and that's going to be a future story that we write because.
Stay tuned.
The series is not over.
Look, this next one is amazing because I, at one point, had a 405 as a company car, Peugeot 405, and it was in Australia from 89 to 97. There were performance variants. That great MI16 was such a terrific front drive handling sedan, but it still continues on in Iran. Courtesy of Iran Quadro Company, IKCO, and it's been selling in various derivatives for 25 years, and it's still badged as a Peugeot. Is that right, Byron?
Yeah, look, I fell down a huge rabbit hole here. Just if you want to fall down the same rabbit hole, it's fascinating. Just start typing in Iranian car industry.
Great.
The IKCO company seems to have a monopoly on manufacturing cars in that part of the world. Yeah. And
funny that
Peugeot has been involved with them for many, many years. Okay. I think it was since, as you said, since the car was still fairly current in Europe, and it's become the Iranian car now. There are different versions with different badges, but manufactured. Yeah, it's still the same car manufactured. There are derivatives of the car as well, as we'll find out in a moment.
Would there be a Ute? I want to say there's a Ute version.
Yeah, but am I making that up? That's coming up with the piece de resistance of my story. That's the earliest car. Yeah,
yeah.
I'll explain that. But yeah, what I'm saying is that it just shows the fundamentally sound design of that. It's a Pininfarina design that was released on the world market in late 1987.
Super clean. Yeah,
it just looked great. And as you mentioned, the MI16 is one of the great forgotten driver's cars of that period. I would have one in a heartbeat. Mm. And in my mind, it was a better car to drive than a 205 GDI, which is sacrilege. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. We had a new 205 GDI in the family at the time, and a 405 MI16, and I know which one I prefer. So
yes. All right. Well, the next one is another Peugeot, and it's a 206 that continues on in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Again by IKCO, but it was in Australia 1999 to 2007.
Mm-hmm.
Successor was a reasonably strong period for Peugeot relative to where they'd been previously. Great little car, but it continues on as a sedan.
Yep.
I reckon that'd be good to drive, actually. Oh, 206 was excellent.
It was, it's Peugeot's best-selling car ever.
Mm.
Is that right?
Yeah, the most successful Peugeot in history remains the 206 because it's still being built.
I see.
I think actually I didn't make it clear in my story, so apologies. But I think there's also the hatch also continues, but I couldn't find information other than a reference to it. So I see.
Okay.
It's the 206 again. Peugeot doing something right with design and packaging.
Well, the next one, it is a beauty. This is a highlight.
This is worth waiting for, folks. If you stayed this long in this podcast, you're about to be rewarded.
The progression of this car from a Roots Group product. So we're talking about the Hillman Hunter that was a part of the Aussie landscape in the 1960s and into the early 1970s. And as you point out, Byron, yes, it won the London to Sydney Marathon.
Others were running at the time, weren't they? Actually, on foot.
The Citroen DS was on track to win that particular race, you may recall, James, but it crashed.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Just all right. Well,
car behind me,
the Iran theme continues here as well, because it's built in Iran as the Pakyan, and it's basically the national car, you're saying, and that there is, in fact, a Ute version of the Hillman Hunter on sale in Iran right now today.
Okay, so so this is the rabbit hole I was talking about earlier. So the Hillman Hunter platform continues. The Pakyan was discontinued only a few years ago because it just got too old. The tooling just got too worn out. And this was the 1967 Hillman Hunter.
Just very wonky panels.
They weren't good, but they were new, right? So the Hillman Hunter, which, was, by the way, was going to be a Humber for BMC and Roots Group fans out there. So this particular Hunter, the platform was used in conjunction with a 405 body, and you can buy a very inexpensive Iranian Peugeot 405 that's using a Hillman Hunter base.
A 405 Ute body on a Hillman Hunter platform.
And sedan.
Wow.
There's also
in
sedan
Iran
version.
And
there's
sedan.
Also, yeah. And it's called.
Wow. I want one.
Yeah. And so you can tell it's a 405 based Ute because the doors and the front part are 405. And then, of course, it's got a Ute body. But to think that there's a 1967 Hillman Hunter, just like keeping your butt from the road.
Do you know, my best mate and I took a brief from his mother to dispose of her Hillman Hunter. And we got a car trailer, took it up to the recycling part of the local, tip. And I always think it's sad when you see a car at the end of its life.
Yeah.
It's about to go back to nature and all that stuff. I was thinking, as we're driving away, he just goes, stop the car. So, oh, okay, what are you going to do here? Make a little, you know, poem or something about the car. He got out, started jumping up and down on the car's roof going, that's for when you wouldn't start at 2 a.m. when I wanted to come home from, and this is for when you wouldn't get out of second gear on the bridge and just put the boot in, literally, at its dying, you know, stage. I couldn't breathe. It was so funny. He just took it out on him.
Do you know what's sad? Sad, though, that Iran has a thriving car manufacturing industry, but Australia doesn't.
Oh, there you go. That's so deep.
It's a great point.
If you had a microphone, you would drop it.
Don't. Now, one more to finish off our list. The 1-2-1. So that's a name that doesn't exist anymore. But 1-2-1 Mazda was 1986 to 1990. Yes. And of course, there was a Ford Festiva. You mentioned it earlier, Richard. Mm-hmm. There was a Festiva equivalent. It was also known as the Kia Pride. So it's technically the DA series, 1-2-1. And guess where it lives on? Iran.
As
the Saipa Pride. And you mentioned, Byron, that it took a little hiatus, force majeure, but there's enough stock that it's still a top-selling car in that country.
Yeah, yeah. There are some websites that show you what the global bestsellers are by country and region, and it shocked me that in the last 12 months that car was number two in Iran.
Wow.
Yeah, still.
Unreal.
And we're talking about the 1-2-1 Fun Top and the same car that Sharon Strzelecki drives pretty much in Kath and Kim. We're talking
about that 1-2-1 shape, I think, set the styling for the next 10 years, possibly 20.
In your head.
I thought it was until that point, cars were quite angular. And that was, to me, I remember seeing that in the playground because the school teacher drove it in high school. And I remember thinking, that looks futuristic.
But when I saw the Fun Top, I said, wow, I want one of them.
Yeah. Like, it was such a
big sunroof. Like, it was almost a cabriolet. Yeah, the sunroof was so big.
Hey, that car had Audi Quattro style blistered wheel arches. Do you remember the square DA?
Wow, that's a reach, isn't it? Like,
I think Mazda said we were inspired by Audi.
The Audi Quattro.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you could say you're inspired by the Lamborghini Aventador, but whether it comes to pass.
Look. It's still around, so I think it's a survivor.
That's our rundown of cars that live on, having appeared in our market, but living on elsewhere. Fabulous chat. Thank you. It'd be great to get everybody's feedback on what they make of that. Which ones do you want to come back? Which ones were you waving a fond farewell to?
Which ones do you want to ban, like the S-Cross?
That's right.
You're exciting. Discourse here, Mr.
What?
Mister?
There are cars here that should be zombies.
Now, where we would normally, under normal non-COVID circumstances, go to our garage in terms of what we've been driving in recent times, we're going to go a little bit further back in history and ask for your memorable drives. And Richard, you've got a great one. It's some time ago in a car that was built even longer ago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So when I first met my wife about, it would have been 15 years ago, we were going out and I was just getting into hot rodding, which I'm fully immersed in nowadays. And her father is a big hot rod builder up on Sydney's or New South Wales Central Coast. And he was going to a hot rod run. And I'm like, I'd like to go to a hot rod run. And he goes, well, I'll take the 37 pickup and why don't you take the 1935 pickup with Amanda? And I'd never driven a hot rod before. And I drove this gold, her name was Ginger, gold 1935 pickup hot rod all the way from Newcastle to Port Macquarie in the pouring rain.
Nice.
I remember, I think at the time I was driving the new Volkswagen Passat and it was a test car for a magazine I was working on years ago. And getting out of the Passat into a, 1935 pickup was like going to a Flintstone car.
Yeah.
It was It was raining the whole time.
Could one of the first deficiencies you noticed be the windscreen wipers? Was there a lack of action?
Okay,
there?
So the windscreen wiper itself was like a comb, there was just one. And I discovered that it didn't work at all. In pouring rain, you may as well have turned it off. But I stopped at a petrol station and I bought these wipes and I didn't even know they existed because being a new car type of guy until then, I didn't realize these. These were the wipes that you wipe the whole windscreen, which is literally about that because it had been chopped. It was about that high.
Like a letterbox.
And I wiped this stuff over it. And honestly, it was better than any windscreen wipes
I've done.
Yeah, it was like Rain-X. I think Rain-X. That was the actual brand. And it worked so well. It had a original chassis, a 1935 chassis, but it had some modern running gear in the form of a 351 Clevo Ford V8. Mm-hmm. I think it had a Holden front end like a lot of them do. And it was my baptism.
Great.
You know, into the industry or into the, you know, the scene. And I loved it. And I entered it and I power parked it up with a whole lot of other pickups. And then I just drove it again and again, you know, all weekend, and then drove it all the way home in the rain. And I've never been wetter or happier in my life.
Oh, that's unreal. So, oh, that's very good. Mm. That's very good. Good on you, Richard.
That story's got everything. It's got love, sex,
does.
Moisture.
Yes. Moisture.
Wetness, Rain-X. It's got it all.
It was.
Now, Byron, very damp. Time for you to pick up the baton here and give us a rundown on your memorable drive, vehicle, place, time.
Okay, so... as you can see from my background, I do like French cars, not necessarily brand new ones, but I love French cars. And I reckon I've been put on this planet to, from a vocational point of view, to address the myth that French cars are not reliable or suited to Australia, because I've done two long drives in very old French cars. Well, I should say two. I've made probably 32, but one was in a 504 and one was in a Renault 16 TS, or 16, not a TS. And it just...
TL.
Actually, it wasn't, because it was a very early, almost pre-production model.
So it was just 16.
So it was just a 16. So it was it was strip speedo, quite basic, bench seat, amazing. Anyway, 3 or 4 years ago, my friend Marty and I decided to... we live in Melbourne. We decided to go up to Wollongong via Sydney. We flew up.
I think, did you say Newcastle?
Oh, look, I said Newcastle, but I had just woken up when I told you this story.
So Wollongong is a little bit south of Sydney.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And we went in there actually in a prototype Kia Stinger that one of my colleagues was driving at the time, pre-release one. So it was 2017, and we got a lift down to Wollongong, and we jumped into a 1968, but late 67 built Renault 16 that hadn't been driven for 5 years. We bought the car sight unseen, checked the oil, had the vendor recharge the battery, had a couple of tools with us, and we bombed it down to Melbourne. It did not miss a beat.
Unreal.
We drove it through rain, pelting rain, through just howling winds. The only thing that went wrong with this car is the right-hand side main beam light bulb went out, which we...
Is that it? I see.
Was it.
Did you have to stop for Rain-X, or the wipers did work?
Only for my glasses, because I was sweaty and look, the moral of that story is that car, a Renault 16, an early front-wheel drive, like hatchback era, family car, just had the comfort, the brakes, the steering,
It's a four-speed column shift, isn't it?
And it was a four-speed column shift, which is so beautiful to use. And that sort of car, you realize why column shifts made sense, because you're not reaching as far out or down as you are in a manual transmission. Your hands are up, so you know.
And the floor was perfectly flat in the front. So,
and the bench seat is sumptuous.
Beautiful seats.
Anyway, and it had kind of that manual thing where you pop a lever and the fresh air comes from somewhere underneath the windscreen straight into your face. And that's really refreshing, unless you're driving through locals.
Very direct approach.
Yeah.
Very direct approach.
Anyway, so we got back safely, and we couldn't believe we managed that in a 40, it was a 68, so a 49-year-old Renault that basically had not been driven. for 5 years. And by the way, when I was younger, I used to go to my best friend used to live in Canberra, and I used to go from Melbourne to Canberra and pick him up, and we go to raves in Sydney in my 1979 Peugeot 504. That by that stage was 25
great
years
car
old.
For that great car for that
just did it, so
it would eat it up. So brilliant. Okay, well, I'm going to stick on the Renault theme because it's a vehicle that enabled me to really bond with my brother. He's a fair bit older than me, and I didn't really make any sense to him until I could speak with him. So then when I could actually hand him a spanner, I made even more sense. And it was a time when the Renault 4 was being kind of abandoned around the place. You'd just see them on the roads. They weren't worth much, so people would just leave them. And he saw this as an opportunity and would just collect that car, make sure that it had been abandoned, clear it with the council. We'd bring it back, strip the useful parts off it, and he would work on other people's R4s. And I was his spanner guy. And the R4, it's its 60th anniversary this year in 2021. There have been 8 million of them made and sold in 100 countries, including Australia. And it was built in Heidelberg in Victoria for a couple of years, 4 years, 62 to 66. And we owned several of those. My brother had, you know, if you wanted to add them up, all the ones that he acquired, it was 25 odd, you know, Renault 4s. And when it came time for me to get a car, there was just this stack of spare parts everywhere. I thought it's madness not to have one. So I owned 3 or 4 as well. And it was front wheel drive, and it was a hatchback, and the rear seat folded, and it was so far ahead of its time in that sense. Just a little 750cc four cylinder that I can guarantee you, I can attest, you can lift out of the engine bay. You don't need an engine hoist.
What a man. What a guy, hey, Richard.
And the three-speed transmission, the gearbox was in front of the engine and just drove straight out to the front wheels. So then you had a rod went straight up out of the gearbox connecting to a horizontal rod that poked out the dashboard with a curve and a little bulb on the end. So you changed your gears out of the dash. So convenient and so direct. It was really great fun. You're talking about a 55 horsepower, about 41 kilowatts, and it only weighed 700 kilos. And over time, it continued on. There were van versions, there were bigger engines, you got a 4-speed, but it was a torsion bar suspension. And I worked out that you could drop it to its lowest level, and it looked like it was using ground effects. If you put skirts on the car, it probably would have sucked itself to the road. It looked amazing. So I had one which was affectionately known as the ground effects machine. And that everything was so very simple. You know, the seats were a tubular frame with then a webbed kind of vinyl seat on the top. So you were just suspended in this really simple but comfortable seat. One that I bought, someone had built runners and put timber drawers under the seat so you could actually, you had little glove boxes under each front seat. It was just amazing. And we even had seen the plein air roofless version, and my brother and I got out the hacksaw and tried to convert one, and even thought about taking it to the registry office, and then, you know, thought better of it. But I understand there's going to be an electric version in similar fashion to the retro R5. There might even be an R4 making a comeback. So I'm looking forward to that. But it was a super special car.
Known as a Renault 4 ever. By the way, as in
is
for
it?
EV,
the Renault 4
ever. Forever.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, James, that's a great story, because the Renault 4 is a forgotten piece of Australian
beautiful.
History as well.
And you know the thing that a friend of ours, a colleague of ours, Jonathan Hawley, was thinking about buying one, and he asked for my advice because he knew that I'd had a few of them. And the thing that I said to him is, make sure that it's on Michelin X tyres, those very early radials. Because often in Australia, they were sold with conventional tyres, but they were made for that Michelin X. And you put them on and it transforms the car. It's such a delight to drive. It leans like a mad dog, but it hangs on like you wouldn't believe. It's fantastic. It's
one of the sort of the common themes here, I think, with the cars that we've driven is that, and you don't really get it with new cars these days, is that you arrive at your destination feeling like you've made it.
There's this
kind of ecstasy that you've just gone, oh my God, we're alive, we did
it. The R4, you know, my brother Johnny put it to me beautifully one time. He said, James, these are for French farmers who just want to put stuff in the back. It might be a pig, it might be some hay bales, but they also need it to serve as family transport. And the designers, if they needed to put something somewhere, they just go, right, put a hole, self-tapper, put it there. It was so basic yet so beautifully functional. Really, really good.
And the car had longevity too, because it was made till 1991.
I know. And it had become the kind of, it was in the latest stages of Elvis life. You know, it had the tassels on the sleeves, and it was a bit bloated because they'd put a full dash in it, and they'd put proper seats.
The Las Vegas stage.
It was his Las Vegas stage.
People also forget that the Renault 4 was rebodied as the Renault 5.
Well, the Renault 5 was such an important car that tragically never made it here. You would think it was a no-brainer, but it never made it to this market.
The closest it got to Australia was Noumea.
It just broke down in Noumea? Couldn't get any further.
Hey, the whole point is that French cars don't break down.
I'd stop in Noumea.
Well, it was funny, as the R4 got older and older, and Renault dealers didn't stock the parts, you could find all the parts in Noumea and get them drive shafts, the whole thing.
Oh, really?
Bit. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. So, but apparently, just like in the mid-90s, in the mid-70s, there was French nuclear testing in the Pacific, which put the kibosh on the 5 coming to Australia.
Mururoa Atoll. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Or bless you, I should say.
Okay, now we'll move on and we'll move through this. It's feedback from last episode, and it was happily, Byron, built around one of your stories, which was about creative ways to sidestep the queue that exists for popular Toyota models. And we got some good responses. Lofty Visions was kind enough to say, great podcast. So thank you, Lofty. But he's tested a fair few hot hatches before he bought his GR Yaris. Lucky person, Lofty. His first Toyota, so he's no fanboy. None of them felt as special as the GR. The Fiesta ST, said, cheaply built, seats too tight. I30N, great, but scary axle tramp. And he's seen similar kind of responses in I20N reviews as well. And if you're spending a big wad of cash, it has to have that special edge. And the GR was the only car that felt comfortable, and he was used to turbos and all-wheel drive because he'd had various Subarus, but nothing came close. He says, I absolutely love it, even if it does look a little bit like a roller skate, smiley face. We did have a bit of a dig at the way the car looks, but he's in love with the car that he's bought and was happy that he waited to buy it.
I concur. I've been driving a GR Yaris, and even at $56,000, that thing,
it's special. So special.
It's unique in the world.
And Roto Ihu, another one of our regular commenters, says that we were talking about the idea of a car being greater than the sum of its parts. Somehow you look at a car on paper, assess the tech spec sheet and go, oh, yeah. But then in the driving, it is really special. He says, look, it's a GR Yaris. It's like half a Yaris, half a Corolla. And you put a little three-cylinder in it, what could that be? And, of course, it's incredible. But he did make the point, Byron, and it'd be good to get your thoughts. Did we look into availability in some of these alternatives? He understands that Mitsubishi's been rushed for the new Outlander in the Aussie market, but supply is a bit tight. Could be that you're waiting just as long as for a RAV4. And I think you made the point in the story that you should be tapping your Mitsubishi dealer right now getting ahead of things. Is that fair to say?
Yeah,
absolutely. Social distancing. No tapping.
Well, that's right. Physically. It's an elbow, not a
Definitely. I think you definitely need to jump straight into it if you want to buy a car, regardless of whether it's new or used, because there's so much demand. And yeah, just contact your Mitsubishi dealer and also your Nissan dealer, because I talked about the Qashqai, I think, being another one of the cars. Their order books are opening in a couple of weeks' time, and they've actually said, look, our order books are opening in a couple of weeks' time. Get in now.
Looks good.
Yeah. Well, you know, Richard, you'll be pleased to know that Dekul came in with some feedback. He agrees with us that Mitsubishi has been flying under the radar. You know, they're pushing out ASXs left, right, and center. He notes that they've dialed up the warranty and cap price servicing, which is a big shot across Toyota's bows. Other old models weren't selling that badly, seeing a lot of Outlanders. And then they've got new product coming with Outlander and Eclipse Cross and
Lancer Evo.
been heavily advertising the PHEV version 2 may be a better alternative to the Corolla Cross, and that there's a fair chance that Mitsubishi could take a big chip out of Toyota's market share. And he's looking at the success of the RAV4 Hybrid and just saying, why didn't Hyundai, Kia, Ford with the Escape, didn't they bring PHEVs and hybrids from the get-go? It's beyond his comprehension. They could have been gold mines. I think Hyundai with IONIQ got in there as quickly as it could, but are there other opportunities that they've missed, do you think?
I think so, and I think we'll see this replicated as we head towards electric vehicles. I think what will happen is that those manufacturers that have got EVs out now will be like Toyota, which have already got, you know, hybrids pretty much, you know, for each model in the entire lineup. It's too late. You can see that the others are playing catch up. There should have been a Tucson hybrid. There should have been a, you know, there is a Escape hybrid, but not in Australia. So I think they're playing catch up. I think, yeah, he's absolutely right.
Well, it's you know, Toyota had the gumption to really roll the dice on hybrid and say, we're going to give it a big push, you know, more than 20 years ago. And that could have failed, and we'd all be laughing about what a joke, you know, Toyota's hybrid efforts were. But it's paid off. It's a big risk, and they're, absolutely, you know, reaping the benefits.
Yep.
Byron, go ahead.
I was just saying, the market is rewarding the brave in this situation.
Totally. Now, Jim Danik, we were talking about brand loyalty and how people buy brands and then think about the product was the rationale. He says, quote, brand loyalty is real. He's been a Hyundai fan since purchasing his first i30 in 2009, and he's since bought six. So he turns them over, you know, every couple of years, or he's just got a garage with six Hyundai i30s.
Oh, he's a Jim Danik Motors. He's a Hyundai dealer. Of course he's
honest
loyal.
Honest Jim's Hyundais. He's just put a deposit, though, on an Isuzu MU-X because he needs to tow things. He would have preferred a Hyundai option, you know, if it was available. So he says he's happy with his purchase, but not excited, which is an interesting way of putting it. And he's such a Hyundai devotee. He would have liked to have stayed loyal to that brand. TGV, the very fast train, says it only took, 18 months for you to get a microphone. Now, he may have been pointing that criticism in my direction, and I'd say, no, I've had this microphone for more than 18 months, but properly configuring it, that's another matter. So
still working it out.
It might have taken a little while. So thanks for pointing that out, Fast Train. But he also says he never aspired to purchase Toyota. He's seen family, friends, work colleagues all have issues with various models. Toyota relies too much on its reputation. It's all they have left, as their vehicles aren't that good. So he's someone who is in the anti-Toyota camp, as evidenced by the experience of people close to him, which is an interesting perspective.
I mean, it's just tall poppy syndrome going on there.
Do you think it's automotive tall poppy syndrome?
Yes.
I don't know. I was behind a Hilux the other day, and its PDF its particular filter.
The PDF
was just the sheet
was just floating along the road,
belching out smoke in my way.
A4 sized.
Well, I was driving my Citroen BX behind it, thinking, why?
And then you opened up that direct air flap. No, that's the Renault 16.
That's right. A 16, yeah.
No, well, just to finish off the comments, our old mate, Senior Bob, thank you, Senior.
Hey.
He says, great show, boys. And Dave Morley was with us last week and talked about his incredible trip along the Silk Road on motorcycles through all the stands, Tajikistan, blah, blah, all the stands.
Yep.
And Senior said, incredible experience. What bike was that? DR650 BMW. And I checked with Dave and Senior.
Posty bike.
It wasn't a posty bike. It wasn't a step through even. 2012 Suzuki DR650. So you picked it. That was the bike he chose. And it obviously gave him good service on that incredible and quite arduous journey. But with that, we have reached the finish line.
Oh.
So thank you for joining, Byron.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, Richard.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, everybody.
And thanks to our crisis negotiator, paranormal gatekeeper, and fortune cookie writer, Mr. Pritchard, for his subtle yet decisive work in the Cars Guide production suite. Today, he's wearing a T-shirt saying, if you ever need nothing, I'm totally here for you. The Macho Man Randy Savage wrestling trunks and Godzilla boots. Incredible look. Jump into the conversation. Cars Guide is on Facebook and Instagram, or email us at comments@carsguide.com.au. Apple Podcast listeners, please take a moment to rate and review the show. 5 stars would be preferred. 5 is the correct number. Thank you. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to subscribe to the Cars Guide YouTube channel so you can stay on top of all our latest content. Now, next week is episode 200, and we are hosting an all-in Royal Rumble podcast cage fight.
It is.
With as many of our regulars as possible joining the show.
We're going to get our shirts off.
Miss it. Don't miss it. Yeah, we're moving all the furniture to the edges of the room, and it's going to be on. But look, before we go, deep in the bowels of a Toyota Mirai, two hydrogen atoms are heading towards the fuel cell when suddenly one shouts, "Damn it, I lost my electron." The other atom asks, "Are you sure?" First one says, "Yes, I'm positive."
Oh.